This is Barry Haywood, recorded at Oundle in Northamptonshire on the 4th of September 2009 by Chris Eldon Lee. Barry Haywood, Part 1.
Barry Haywood, baptised Ronald Barry Haywood, because that was a family name. My dad was Ronald Haywood and his dad was Ronald John Haywood and etc. I didn't have any sons, so that crushed that. I was born in Castle Gresley, and that was on the 28th of September 1937, which seems a long time ago now.
So you're Lancastrian by birth?
Well, not by birth, no. I'm a Derbyshire lad by birth. It's just a family originated, on my father's side, originated from there. But there's Welsh blood in the family, because his mother was Welsh speaking and came from Bagot in Flintshire. And it was the pressure of seeking work that moved them from the Vale of Bowland to Flintshire, from Flintshire to the Peak District, and from the Peak District to South Derbyshire, and that's where my mother came in, who was a Leicestershire family, and her family came from Breeden over centuries, literally. If you go to Breeden on the Hill, you'll find the graveyards almost full of Bradburys, and my mother always used to say that once they started quarrying away the hill on which the church was built, it was only the Bradbury tombstones that kept the church up.
Were there any hints of your future career in your childhood?
Well, like all children at that time, you know, we were born before the war. There was a period of austerity in the war and after the war. I mean, the family was very poor. I mean, my father was, shortly after I was born, was ill for 7 years with kidney trouble. And my mother brought us up on literally about five bob a week. And so we found our entertainment by walking and being outside. I mean, I used to get a scalping off my mother, not because I wouldn't go out, not because I was watching television, but because I would be out from 8 o'clock in the morning until almost after dark, and she wondered where I was. But me and my mates would be out there, and we used to scrump apples in season and dig up potatoes and turnips and everything and just eat them raw, you know, go out all day. So, and of course, we were so close to the Peak District and all the walks around there, and also cycling. I remember forming a cycling club with a couple of friends, and we used to cycle over the country. And so, in a sense, I've always liked to be out and be very active. I didn't think about the Antarctic at all. I mean, I was brought upon Rider Haggard, and I'd read about Scott, of course, but when I went to university, my thoughts were turned towards Africa. But, of course, during my period at university, the political situation in Africa, any decent person would rebel against it. And so I lost interest in Africa. I was doing research in Birmingham, and I went on a climbing holiday in the Coolings in Skye, coming back. Well, what happened was that we were destined to come back on the Saturday, and the Saturday was a very wet, windy day, and a couple of blokes went climbing on the Coolings, and it's gabbro, which is like soapstone when it's wet. It's good when it's dry, but when it's wet, it's very, very slippy. And they peeled off, and one bloke was seriously injured, and they came down to where we were camped and asked if we had any volunteers to help them to bring this bloke in. And my friend Frank and I, we were both six footers, and so we volunteered. And, of course, by the time we got this bloke down, it was rather late, so foolishly we decided to drive through the night. I drove the first stint, and we got to the outskirts of Lockerbie. And then Frank took over and sadly fell asleep at the wheel, veered across the road, was hit by this flatbed lorry with a trailer, which was carrying about 20 odd ton of cement in sacks on it. Frank was killed. I was caught up on the tarpaulin hook of the lorry, and I was rolled between the two and left for dead on the side of the road, but had the good fortune to groan on the way to the morgue. So they whipped me into a hospital in Dumfries, where I spent the best part of 6 months there, being put together slowly, bit by bit, because that was the... I was very fortunate, actually, because there were... There were only five maxillary surgeons in the country at the time, and one happened to be in Dumfries. So, although I'd got a silver plate in the a metal plate in the jaw here, and lost most of my teeth, and was badly smashed up, he was able to rebuild my face so that wasn't too disfigured, although. For a long time, I put the jaws on one side, and when I came out of hospital, I had to go to Birmingham Hospital and every week to have a new denture made that gradually swung my jaw back, because there's no on this side there's no joint, so it's held in with the tendons and sinews, you know, to hold it in place, sort of thing. So.
How old were you at that point, Mary?
Oh, good question. About 21, 22, I think.
Still at university?
I was doing research there, yes. And I was doing research in insect neurophysiology. And I found I was having to do some very delicate operations, you see. I used to use the same sort of scissors and tweezers and things that eye surgeons use. And when I came out, my hands were like this, you know. And I couldn't do that, so... I was advised to write up my work for an MSc, which I did, and then I was looking around for a job. But just so happened that the Society for the Advancement of Science was a meeting at Birmingham, and our Chancellor, who was Sir Raymond Priestley, came there. He linked up with a chap called Bill Sloman, who was then the Institute Secretary of the Falkland Islands Dependency Survey. And I met him while I was taking some school kids around to the various exhibitions, and got chatting and told him my story. And Sir Raymond Priestley said, "Well, why don't you come with us?" And that was the very, very first time that it ever entered my head about the Antarctic or going down there.
You knew where it was,
did? Oh, roughly, yes. I know it was the bottom end of the country, that not many people in the world, not many people do. They always say, "How do you get on with the Eskimos and the polar bears?" And although I was engaged at the time, it was too good an opportunity if they could actually take me. And... Bill Sloman always joked with me afterwards, saying that they didn't know whether to put me on half pay or quarter pay because there was so little of me there. And so I have this unique claim to fame that I did my recuperation in the Antarctic.
So this is immediately after the accident?
Yes, the accident happened in the August of 1960, when I was 23, that's right. Well, not quite 23. And by the following September, I was on the John Biscoe heading south.
Two questions then about that. One is, did the fact you'd had the accident give anybody any second thoughts about you going to such a remote part of the world?
Well, my parents weren't very happy about it, but then again, no parents are anyway, whether you're robust or not. And I think Bill Sloman had some reservations, but I don't know whether it was the name or what, but the senior medical person at the time for Fitz was a Colonel Hayward, spelled H-E-Y-W-O-O-D, which is what I always say is the right way. And whether he thought, you know, well, there must be some connection here to let me down, I don't know. I mean, it was very funny because when I was 14 stone and it was all up here, before the accident happened. And when I was weeks and weeks in a plaster cast that was went from my crutch, arms out here, and my head in one too. And the weight just melted from me, you know, and I was a sort of a near 11 stone weakling when I went down to the Antarctic. But I've always, you know, been hardworking and I suppose tough really, because I did persevere and did the work I had to do down there without too much effort. But from time to time, I would be really ill without really knowing why. And it wasn't until my last summer when the chief medical officer from the Falkland Islands was on the ship. And I got talking to him, and I spoke about this. And he looked at, you see, I've got a dimple sort of thing there. And he was doing that, you know, and I'd noticed before that little bits of pus would come out from time to time. And it turned out afterwards, because I got examined in Port Stanley and went to see the dentist, and they took out one of my few remaining teeth. And I'd had an abscess in my jaw all the time I was there. And apparently this was where they'd put the pins in to hold the parts of the jaw in place. And obviously some of the plaster had got in. The plaster of Paris had got in there. And over the 2 or 3 years, it had festered away and it had eaten part of the jawway. So I was down there with this recurrent abscess all the time, which would come and go and come and go, you know. And so I've just assumed, well, he said that was probably the reason why I would have these periods when I didn't feel well, you know. And
Sometimes close calls change people's philosophy on life. You know, you were left for dead, but you lived a full life afterwards. But do you think the life you led afterwards was shaped by the fact you had a near-death accident? In other words, were you more adventurous or more cautious, or couldn't care less anymore, living on borrowed time? Did it change your view?
Well, not really, because I always thought, and I like to think most of us do in the survey, that it's not a question of putting your life at risk, but you're putting other people's lives at risk, because it's human nature that if you were in difficulties, other people would try and help you out. And so I think that for anybody under the circumstances in which we worked and still worked in the Antarctic, that you have a responsibility not only to yourself, but to other people, you know. So perhaps I'm not a very philosophical person. I knew damn well that I'd be given a second chance. And it really did swing the direction of my life away, because, of course, I was set up to do the research, stay in university, become a university lecturer and carry on like that. And probably been bored out of my mind. Because, as I've often said, that the Antarctic gave me the opportunity, you know. I mean, what we said about people born in Derbyshire, strong in body and weak in head. And it gave me an opportunity to use brawn and brain, and it was ideal. I mean, so much so that at the end of my first two and a half years, I mean, I tried to get the powers that be to let me go to another base for another year, but because I'd been doing research down there as a scientist, I was told I'd got to come back and write up. But it was a sort of life that I really did lead, and that's the reason I stayed with them until I retired. And I was fortunate in meeting Joe, whose father had been a ship's captain, so she was used to not seeing her father, especially the wartime. She didn't see him for about 7 years, and so, she, in a sense, she just was able to accept my going away so often for so long each time.
You were interviewed by two famous names, Priestley and Sloane. What did you make of them as men?
Well, Sir Raymond Priestley, of course, you looked at him with awe, because he'd been down with Scott, and they'd been down when it was really hard, and he'd survived, and he was a very nice, friendly man. I mean, and I met him for several years after, well, used to meet him about once a year till he died. And, of course, Bill Sloman, I got to know very well. And in fact, Bill and Peggy were having dinner with us just, I think it was less than 2 weeks before his heart attack and died. Mm. So, I mean, they were great friends. I mean,
tell me about Bill.
Bill was very much an Indian Army man, you know, and I used to be amazed at his recall. He could remember everybody's name and everything. And it was only when I was in a senior position in the survey that I realised that we had these crib cards. And when I went down on the ship to visit the bases as a deputy director and then as a director, I'd have my crib cards. And, of course, what you did your homework so that when you got on the base, you knew who he was. Don't ask me now. Because that's one of the embarrassing things if you work for the survey for getting on for 37, 40 years. During that time, every year we take on 60 to 100 people. You're there all the time, so everybody knows you. But when you go to reunions, which I do, so many people I know is, oh, hi, yeah, how are you doing?
What would you say Bill's qualities were?
He's very genial. A very friendly man. I think he was firm at the right time. I don't think I can't remember me giving him any cause to be very firm with me during my junior days. And I think he was very capable. I mean, he held down a job in FIDS and then in Bass, when really the home support staff was rather low in numbers, and Bill kept the whole thing running. I mean, I think Sir Raymond, Sir Vivian Fuchs was one of those people that was a doer. And he was a natural leader, and I think people had to fall in behind him and make sure that things could be done, if you know what I mean. I'm not sure. I'm not sure to what extent that he went into the fine detail, but I must tell you that, I mean, when you're junior in rank, you don't know too much about these people. I mean, Bunny Fuchs, we became great friends over the years, and again, I mean, I used to go, Joe and I used to go and see him, and his first wife, whose name just escapes me for the minute, and then Helen, his second wife. We used to go and see them fairly regularly. And then after Bunny died, we went to see Helena. And then she moved. I'd retired by then. And she'd moved to somewhere in... I think it may be still in Northamptonshire. It may be in South Esher. But Joe and I used to cycle over there and go and see her. Because she was a very lonely person, moving away. I think both Bunny Fuchs and Eleanor became quite lonely, although they were still living in Cambridge. It's just that they'd been so much at the centre of things that as Bunny had had his strokes and everything and had to lead a more quiet life and, in fact, probably very rarely left home, they missed the company. But and that's not why Joe and I went to see them. That's because we looked upon as friends as ours and...
Is it true that the modern day Bass is built on those two personalities, Slangman and Food?
I'm a little surprised that's said, really, because there have been many strong people since then. I mean, Dick Laws took over from Bunny Fuchs, and it was under his. Leadership, we really went to be a mainly scientific organisation rather than the survey onward and outward sort of thing. I mean, the need provides the man, I think. I mean, Bunny Fuchs is the right sort of person to steer it from being the Falkland Island Dependency Survey to working under Research Council, NERC. And then Dick Laws took over, another strong character that was able to resist what seemed to be often the machinations of NERC to get their hands on our money. And at the same time, on a very small budget, turn it into the scientific organisation, well, give the foundation for the scientific organisation it is today. And the real upturn in the Bass Funds came under Margaret Thatcher. David Drew was the director then. I was his deputy. We went up and we were given a half-hour slot. And we'd really honed this talk down and got it really slick.
Pardon? You knew what was coming when you went to see her?
Oh, yes. We were going to tell her about our work and how important it was.
This is after the Falklands War?
This is after the Falklands
War.
But
you were called in, weren't you? Did she not call you in?
She wanted to know about the survey. And they wanted a reason for the British presence down there rather than just the we're sitting on the land, so it's ours sort of thing. A good reason to sell to the country for providing the support. For being down there. And as I say, we were given a half-hour slot, and I remember going in there, and David was going to do the talk. I was sorting out the slides, and Baker came in. He was Minister of Education and Science at the time. He said, show me your slides. And I said, I'm sorry. I said, they're in order, and we don't know when the Prime Minister's coming in. Now, look, I want to see the slides. And we're having this argument when she came in. And Baker was looking daggers at me and thought, well, that's the end of my career sort of thing. But then Maggie Thatcher, it was said that she had a five-minute retention span. If you haven't got her attention by then, forget about it. Anyway, before 5 minutes was up, she'd kicked her shoes off and she'd curled up on a chaise lounge like women do. And there was an audible gasp around. You could, well, it wasn't quite audible, but you could feel it as all sycophants, you know, could have said that she had more balls than the whole of her cabinet. So it got it quite right. They all relaxed because the Prime Minister was relaxed and enjoying herself. Anyway, nearly an hour and a half later, this guy that kept coming in and whispering in her ear, and she was like that, finally succeeded in getting through, and she stood up. She said, gentlemen, I'm terribly sorry. I've got to go. There's somebody I've got to see. And or was that effect? She still took time out to go into a darkened area of the room where the technicians were that had helped us carry the gear and set it up to thank them. And then she disappeared. Well, we packed up and we went outside and there was a blaze of television lights and cameras and everything. We thought, my God, we made it. And then we suddenly realised that it must have been an ambassador or somebody really important in the political scene that was coming to see her. And anyway, it was within the week that she went to give her famous We Are Now Green speech to the Royal Society, and we always said it was due to our talk, because she was asking us all sorts of questions about, you know, the fisheries in the North Sea and all these restrictions to it, and I was telling her, well, this is important, the fish stocks have got to recover and you've got to catch the fish of the right size so that they are bred before you take them out of the ecosystem. And that's when we started having money, and it was always ring-fenced, and that really did annoy NERC because they couldn't touch it. It was there, it was ring-fenced. And
let's just go back a bit.
The
Falklands War is on.
Yeah.
And at this point you're not quite deputy director yet, are you?
Oh, no. I was I'd just taken over the Marine Life Sciences at the time.
We'll talk about that in a bit.
Yeah.
Let's just focus on this meeting with Thatch then. So this was a couple of years after the Falklands War.
Yes, something like that. You're probably better on the dates than I am.
All right. You and Drury have gone in to do half an hour.
Yeah.
And found yourself faced with 90 minutes.
Well, it's quite easy, actually, because, everybody on their hobby or pet subject, you can talk. And she was a scientist, you see.
Yeah.
Very rare thing in politics. She was a scientist. She had a PhD in chemistry, I think. And she knew the sort of questions to ask after we'd finished. And
she quizzed you for an hour.
Yes, we were talking all the time, yes. We had this in mind when we were preparing the talk. You know, it wasn't a question of just waffle. We had to be on the ball, giving her a very punchy account of everything we did, from bacteria in the sediments of the ocean through to upper atmospheric physics, you know, solar wind and stuff like that, and everything in between, and to talk about its importance. And of course, in half an hour, with the best slides in the world, you can only just skim over the subject. So there's a great opportunity for any person that's trained in science to ask questions. And she did. And I think, well, I mean, let's push the boat out. So I think she probably enjoyed it as a welcome relief from the normal stuff that she had to do, you know. We thoroughly enjoyed it. We went in there with fear and trepidation, and because she got the reputation as being an ogre. But she turned out to be a very friendly person. And the proof of the pudding happened several years later when she had a meeting in Cambridge that she came up to, and we were approached if she could come and see us first. She'd like to have tea with us. And so this she did, and I was... as I say, I was David's deputy, and we had all the heads of the science divisions in, and also the institute secretary, and she sat there for quite an hour or so with Dennis, her husband, chatting away, and she had a lovely time and thanked us very much and then went off to do her thing. Well, we must have had some impact on her.
that meeting, the number 10 meeting, Did you know you were winning? Did you sense electricity in the room? But when she took her shoes off,
well, as soon as she relaxed, well, it was as I say, her sycophants that really gave us the clue, because they relaxed. They were visibly tense and on edge at the time, and once she'd, as I say, shoes off and sat up there and curled up and started listening to us and listened intently all the way through, didn't interrupt at all, and then started speaking to us afterwards. I mean, yes, we knew that we'd gone down well.
Did you have a figure in your envelope? Did you ask her for a particular sum?
No, because it wasn't the occasion for that. I mean, of course, we knew what we needed to do in addition to what we'd also like to do. And in the discussions that came about afterwards, I mean, these points were raised, and I think it was our income was raised to about 22 million, I think.
Is that what you asked for, or a compromise?
Well, you never get always what you want, I mean. But we also had additional money, of course, because eventually we were able to sort of rebuild Halibay and start on Rothera, and to have the new ship, the James Clark Ross, and all that came in. And well, I mean, the James Clark Ross was 66 million. So.
And that was just government money?
Oh, yes, government money. Yeah, they didn't have this sort of thing called PFI in there. I mean, yeah.
Were you and David Drury comfortable about the fact that you were getting the money for political reasons rather than scientific reasons, or was that not fair?
Well, we were happy because we both firmly believed in the work we were doing. I mean, you don't kick a gift horse in the mouth, or whatever the expression is, do you? I mean, you take the money regardless. And yeah. And it was important we were doing. I mean, even the work that I had done in 61, 62 with very, very limited equipment on the lakes on Cygne Island, I mean, it proved valuable baseline data to see the effect of climate change as we started to recognise was occurring. And, of course, it was the British Antarctic Survey that discovered the ozone hole, again with limited equipment. And thank goodness we did have limited equipment, because the Americans, with their computers and their satellites, of course missed it, because they'd set the gate of acceptable data so narrow that when it felt the information fell outside it, it was dismissed as an instrumental error, you know, instrument error.
So both you and America were looking for the holes, the ozone hole?
No, we weren't looking for it, because what we were doing, pure research, is just looking at things and trying to understand them. And we just so happened, we had people studying the ozone there. And when it seemed to thin, I was a couple of years was spent sort of checking the equipment and making sure that the measurement was such. Well, the Americans had got satellites going around, and they were measuring as part of a suite of measurements ozone there. And as I say, because once you're doing everything with electronics, the amount of data is so vast that really to able to you to handle it, you set a gate, and anything that falls outside it is instrumental error or something's gone wrong. Fortunately for all of us, and especially the Americans, none of the data was ever thrown away because it was all stored. And of course, once Joe Farman and his two colleagues published their paper, then the Americans quickly went scrabbling back through all the data that they received over that time, and sure enough, there was the confirmation. You know,
you'll have to remind me. What were you deputy director at the time of the ozone?
Yeah.
Thank you. Let's just talk about that for a minute. I mean, we're leaping about in your story, but I don't think it matters as long as we cover the territory. Eventually, the chronology is not too critical. But when was the first hint on your desk that there might be a problem with the ozone layer? Can you remember that? That first memo or the first telephone call?
No, I do know that, and I can't put it in any chronological order really, but I do know, I'm trying to think of the man's name. Unfortunate for him, he's the third name on the paper, but he was the one that's going through the data and discovered this seeming drop in the ozone layer, and he pointed this out to his immediate superior, who then took and they checked it, and they took it to then to the head of the unit, which is Joe Farman, and Joe set up this rigorous regime to determine whether the equipment was performing correctly or not, or whether it was some error in the way the measurements were being done, and. And so, I mean, the rumour was going around the survey that this sort of thing was happening. Everybody was getting excited about it. And then, of course, the paper was published and that was it. But
it's a rumour I'm interested in, because at some point somebody must have said to you, we've got something here that might be interesting.
Yes, but I can't remember the detail in that.
So the word was getting out around Bass quite a long time before it hit public attention.
Yes, I believe so, yes.
And was there a sense inside Bass, in the director's office, was there a sense that you had something very important here?
Oh, I think so. Once it was being ably demonstrated, because, of course, we all knew, and especially, I mean, as biologists and everything, you knew that this would let in UV, and the UV was harmful. So, it was very well, fortunate for us also, the world leaders realised it, because the Montreal Convention, of course, banned the use of the fluorocarbons that were doing it. It was an exciting time, but it's nice to have something like that under your belt then, because as I say, there was always this sniping with NERC to get their hands on some of our money and everything, and people down in Antarctic, you know, you got the sense that they wondered why we were down there. We were just having a damn good time at the country's expense. But we were able to say, well, look, this alone is worth every penny that's been spent in the Antarctic, that information.
This could save mankind?
Well, forewarned is forearmed. I mean, look at the incidence of skin cancer that's occurring even now in Australia, in spite of the fact that everybody there is very conscious of the fact that for a large part of the year there's a big ozone hole over them. And of course, it's in New Zealand now, and it's spread, and it's in South America too, Chile and Argentina. And of course, the same thing is occurring in the Arctic, but because of the topography of the Antarctic, because of the topography of the Arctic, where although you've got a flat central piece, which is the frozen sea, the mountains on the surrounding continents cause turbulence in the air mass, which of course breaks up the air. But the ozone is being depleted there just as much as in the southern hemisphere.